This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. President Joe Biden signed into law a $40 billion aid package to fund security, humanitarian, and economic aid to Ukraine, while progressive lawmakers like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and House Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez voted for the bill. Some activists on the left criticized the move. In fact, the left has been split on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, with some compelled to oppose any Western-backed position and others insisting that Ukraine has the right to sovereignty and self-determination. Joining me now is Bill Fletcher Jr., former co-founder of the Black Radical Congress, past president of Trans Africa Forum, writer, trade unionist, and senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies. He recently co-wrote a lengthy analysis for New Politics called When Should We Stop Excusing the Russian Invasion? Welcome to the program, Bill.
Glad to be on board. Thank you.
So was it an accurate characterization that there are some on the left who just don't like the idea of, especially of backing a war? When I say war, I mean a Ukraine war to stop the Russians from invading. That's the war that they don't like to back because the West is aligned behind it.
Yeah, I mean, you summarize it. I think that there are loud voices. I don't know how, I can't really discern how many, but there are loud voices that are basically saying that the Ukrainians are on their own. And in some cases, worse than that, and suggesting that the Russians have a legitimate reason to violate the sovereignty of Ukraine. And so this has become a very bitter split with, you know, those of us on the other side saying that this is a violation of national sovereignty, national self-determination. You don't have to like the Ukrainian regime. What you have to do, though, is recognize that there's something called the violation of international law, which is what the Russians are doing.
The point you just made about you don't have to like the Ukrainians is critical because very early on we heard folks on the left say that there are Nazi factions in Ukraine, and therefore it would be foolish to back Ukraine's fight. I mean, most on the left didn't go as far as believing Putin saying that his war was a war against Nazism, which is what he's been saying. But it sort of amounts to de facto the same thing, right? Ukraine is filled with Nazis, and therefore we shouldn't back their fight.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, Sonali, on this. So first of all, there's fascists in virtually every capitalist country, including the United States. So maybe we should send the military into a few states to clean out the Nazis, which is actually not a bad idea. So that's one issue. The second thing, though, is that this issue ignores that there is an internal matter within Ukraine. Of course there's Nazis there and other fascists, right? But that is an internal matter for the Ukrainian people. The Russians have no right to intervene in Ukraine because Ukraine offered no threat to Russia. Now, on top of that, the Putin regime is not exactly a paragon of democracy. And in fact, one could argue quite convincingly that the Putin regime is absolutely a right-wing authoritarian, if not semi-fascist regime, that is white supremacist, homophobic, internally repressive, externally aggressive. I mean, so on what basis would anyone in their right mind believe that the Putin regime could be those that introduce some sort of progressive transformation of Ukraine? It's just simply not the case. Now, the last thing I'd say about this, I want to remind your viewers and listeners that in 1989, the United States invaded Panama on a pretext that the government of Manuel Noriega was corrupt, was engaged in all sorts of nefarious activities, and that it was up to the United States to take a step to remove the Noriega regime and to imprison Noriega. I don't know any legitimate leftists that rallied with George H.W. Bush in calling for and in supporting that invasion and that clear violation of international law. Well, if that was a violation of international law, how is the Russian invasion of Ukraine any different?
You recently on Real News Network had a conversation with Noam Chomsky, who, you know, is at least 20 years ago was considered the leading foreign policy analyst in the United States. Chomsky remains active. And a lot of folks have taken issue with his position. Ukrainian progressives have taken issue with his position because he seems to fall on the side of, well, even though I don't excuse what Russia did, we should, you know, it's understandable what Russia did. Tell me about that conversation.
It was a fascinating conversation, Sonali, and I have great respect for Dr. Chomsky. That said, we had big disagreements. Central to Chomsky's thinking are two pieces, I'd say. One is that he tends to look at the world in terms of great power politics. And the second is that his view fundamentally comes down to the U.S. has no right to criticize anyone else because the U.S. has a long history of criminal activity. Now, I agree with the latter, that there's a great deal of criminal activity in the history of the United States. There's no question about that. But if you take his position to its logical conclusion, the United States should not have been called upon to slap sanctions on apartheid South Africa in the 1980s. Because after all, we were the country of Jim Crow segregation. We continue to have rampant racist discrimination and oppression here. So on what basis could we criticize? If you took his position to the logical conclusion, in 1936, when the global left rose up to support the Spanish government, when the Nazis, the German Nazis and the Italian fascists intervened in that civil war, and the global left said, no, we can't allow this to happen. We're not only going to volunteer to fight, but we're also going to call upon imperialist governments, United States, Britain, and France, to provide weapons to the Spanish Republic, then following Chomsky's argument, that would never have happened. So I think that the argument is really problematic. But the other part of where I would disagree with Chomsky is that this assumption that everything needs to be seen through the eyes of global politics, so a great power politics. So for example, he made an argument that I found sort of strange, which was, well, clearly, in order to resolve this, the Ukrainians are going to have to give up Crimea, give up the Donbass, and agree to neutralization. Well, you know, that's really good for a North American to say, but what about asking the Ukrainians what they're prepared to give up? If they're prepared to give up anything, and what's happened is as this war has progressed and the brutality of the Russians has become so obvious, the willingness to compromise on the parts of many Ukrainians has weakened, as one could understand, because they're very bitter. So I think that that Chomsky's approach on this is misguided, even though he and I would agree to oppose the Russian invasion. Absolutely.
There's one thing to be said for when Western powers, political leaders take steps to take advantage of an invasion. And it's clear, right, that NATO and the US is benefiting from Russia's invasion because it gives them all of that incentive that they need to say, see, we need NATO after all. Russia is the bad guy, like we've been saying all these years. It's one thing to sort of have those folks, those elites say that. But then when we think about left positions, grassroots leftists like you and I and people on the American left or people on the Ukrainian left or people on the Russian left, the left globally, the posture, in order to be consistent with what most of us believe in, seems to be self-determination, human rights, observing the right to defend oneself when attacked. And it's strange that there isn't that agreement on the global left about it.
That's because you have a segment of the left that looks at matters like self-determination completely in relationship to the United States and not in relationship to the legitimacy or illegitimacy of that demand in particular countries. In other words, they view demands for self-determination when those demands are aimed against the United States or against U.S. allies as legitimate. But in situations when they're not, that's what I mean by relativism. And I've had these strange debates on Facebook with people who will say things like, well, you know, Ukraine is not really a nation, or, you know, self-determination is okay, but it's not always legitimate, particularly when there's fascists involved. So you get these weird qualifications that are related to this notion of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which sends us into a rabbit hole. Now, one of the things that I'm concerned about is regular people out there. I'm less concerned about some of these idiots on the left than I am regular people that we on the left are trying to influence and trying to encourage to not only take a stand on something like Ukraine, but take a stand on Puerto Rico, take a stand on Venezuela, take a stand on Cuba, take a stand on the Philippines, take a stand against any kind of provocation on China, right? So we want to reach people. If we are inconsistent, if people look at us and say, oh, I see what you're saying. So it was okay for Russia to demand spheres of influence and go against Ukraine, but it's not okay for the United States to say Cuba is really in our sphere of influence, or maybe we need to put more restrictions on AMLO in Mexico. Is that what you on the left is saying? Right? It's like you can't talk out of both sides of your mouth. Either we are advocates for national self-determination, or we're not, and we should just admit it. This is what I've been saying to people, Sonali. It's like if you're supporting the Russian invasion, then damn it, just say it. Let's stop being coy. Just say, yes, let's support this authoritarian regime invading a country because we want to deceive ourselves into believing that this maniac who is running Russia is someone who's going to bring legitimate peace and justice to Ukraine. Just say it.
You used the word idiots earlier, and there's, of course, this common phrase, useful idiots, right? And it seems yes. as though Russia has had, Russia, like Syria's leader, Bashar al-Assad, has had useful idiots, quote unquote, on the American left that they have been able to point to legitimize their position.
Yes.
And this, you know, there are not that many of them, but the few that are very vocal and seem to have some influence, right?
Some of them have been friends of mine. And I've watched this strange evolution. You know, there's this notion, Sonali, of what's called a red-brown alliance. It goes back to the 1920s and 30s when some on the radical left were prepared to unite with fascists against social democrats and liberals. And we started to see that again in the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, of some leftists being prepared to unite with radicals on the right who are anti-democracy, sometimes anti-globalization, and folks sometimes think that they can reach some sort of common agreement. A very dangerous course. You know, you see, when you think about the enemy of my enemy is my friend, it can take you down a very, very dangerous path. And one of the things that I stumbled across years ago, and which we introduced in the article about Ukraine, was based on the work of Dr. Ernest Allen from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who studied the rise of a pro-Japanese movement in the United States right before World War II. And if you look at that pro-Japanese movement, and it also, there was a pro-Japanese movement in Asia, in a number of countries. One of the things that you see is this idea that Japan was a advocate in the struggle against Western imperialism, and that Japan had a right, some people would even see it as a right, to expand its sphere of influence. And there were people, even including W.E.B. Du Bois, who were very sympathetic to the Japanese up until the beginning of World War II, and were in many cases willing to excuse away massive Japanese atrocities in Asia, particularly what was done in Manchuria and the rape of Nanjing and other places, because they basically posited that no matter how bad Japan was, it didn't compare with Western imperialism. You've got that same sort of thinking. So even some really good people go down this rabbit hole, and where they stop using critical thinking, they stop thinking dialectically, and are thinking in a very linear way. Okay, if the United States is on one side, we obviously are going to be on the other. There's one colleague of mine whose name will not be mentioned, who said, I mean, we disagree on virtually everything these days, but he said to me with great pride once a few years ago that he opposes everything the United States does. And it's like, well, what does that mean? What does that mean in the real world? And so you have a whole set of people that are really, they're ready and willing to believe anything that Putin says. And we saw that in the Syrian war, where, for example, when the allegations were being made about Russian atrocities, the bombing of hospitals, or Assad's use of poison gas, people didn't want to believe it. Some people didn't want to believe it here because it was the United States that was making the accusation. And therefore, following that logic, if the United States makes that allegation, it can't possibly be true.
Right. There is, seems to be such a desire to prove U.S. elites wrong that you end up on the side of criminal elites from other nations. And what you were saying earlier about nations like Japan, I mean, we've had that in China, right? We've seen some folks try to prove that, prove wrong the assertion that China is a violator of human rights, because there's always the whataboutism. But what about the U.S.? Isn't what we do worse? But both can be true. There's just new evidence of China's internment of Uyghurs in internment camps. And there's definitely been some of the same folks denying China's crimes, that deny Russia's crimes, that deny Syria's crimes, because it's a way to stick it to the U.S. and stick it to the West. Ultimately, of course, when we're talking about Ukraine, which was our original story here, what do you think can the left here support? I mentioned the $40 billion aid package, which, you know, it's hard to stomach $40 billion of U.S. taxpayer dollars going to Ukraine to defend itself when we are struggling, when we need the money for healthcare, education, etc. But should the left take positions on, say, these very tangible ways in which American leaders are stepping into the Ukraine, Russia, the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Yeah, this is complicated. So I would say, first of all, we should not oppose military assistance going to the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians are not going to be able to stop the Russians using harsh language. This is a war. That's one thing. The second thing is that we should absolutely be advocates of peace, but peace necessitates the withdrawal of the Russian troops. The United States should not be an obstacle to a negotiated settlement, but the United States should also not insert itself as an arbiter or as the representative of the Ukrainian people. The Ukrainian people have to make up their own minds. But there's another part of this too, which is that we should demand consistency on the part of the United States when we're looking internationally. So if the United States, if the Biden administration is upset, as it should be, about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it should be equally upset about what Israel has been doing to the Palestinians. The continuous land grabs, the apartheid system that's been established there. The United States should be absolutely concerned about that. If the United States is concerned about what the Russians are doing in Ukraine, They should also be concerned about what the Moroccans have done in Western Sahara, in the occupation of two-thirds of Western Sahara, and their efforts to annex this. So it's that we have to demand of the United States that it follows one standard. And so our argument here is not for this illusion that if we keep yelling peace, that that's somehow going to break through to Putin. But we have to make sure that the United States, which we can influence, takes a consistent stand when it comes to Israel, when it comes to the Western Sahara, when it comes to other places, as opposed to this hypocritical stand. And the hypocritical stand, as we see now, comes back and bites the U.S. in the rear, which is one of the reasons that many countries in the global south have been silent in the context of the invasion of Ukraine, or they have opposed the sanctions, because their argument, which makes perfect sense, is this. If the United States was silent on Israel and Palestine, if the United States was silent on Morocco and Western Sahara, why should we speak up now? And I get that. I really do. There's a logic there. But I would say that aggression anywhere must be stopped, even if it's being articulated in a certain way by the upholders of hypocrisy. Our job, certainly on the left, is to fight for consistency, to fight for democracy, and to fight for national self-determination.
Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We'll post a link to the article that you co-wrote about the left's position, some on the left's position on Ukraine, co-written by with Bill Gallegos and Hamala Rogers. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My guest has been Bill Fletcher, Jr., senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the co-author of a new analysis just published on New Politics called When Should We Stop Excusing the Russian Invasion? I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.